This is John Costa with Rob Watson recording Spotlight on Art. Rob, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, John.
Cool, keeping well?
Today a bit better because the sun's out, whereas yesterday it was oppressive.
Yeah, we're not allowed to mention the weather. You told me that. You told me off a couple of weeks ago.
I didn't say what was oppressive.
Okay.
Well, actually, I didn't mention the sunshine, so obviously.
You have been oppressed.
I know, but the mood that it puts you in is...
It changes people's perspective walking down the street, doesn't it?
You can tell people.
Happier, much happier. Yeah. Anyway, we're back in the basement gallery at the Leicester Adult Education Centre on Beaver Street. If you've never been here and you're listening to this, just pop in. Even if it's empty, it gives you an idea of a basement gallery, which is open and accessible to people. Fantastic toilets. I'd say it's the cleanest toilets in Leicester, actually. But then again, that's through experience. And then there's a nice lift, so it's fully accessible for everybody. And we've had an exhibition, which is coming down today, sadly, Doc Photo 8, the second one we've pulled together. And today, special guests, which is great, is someone who's co-created with me, is Vincy. Vincy, thank you for joining us this morning.
Hi, everyone.
No pressure now, Tony, for you to give us an equally good morning. But also, Tony Shelley's joined us as well.
Delighted to be here. It's been a wonderful 2 weeks meeting other photographers and Vinci. Her work is superb.
Well, there you go. So that's cool. We'll drill down into who your some highlights about the 2 weeks and whose work you enjoy particularly. Everyone's done fantastic. We've had 11 photographers in total that have taken the time to submit their content. Now, Rob, I want to give one of the first words to you because I've known you a long time now. Yeah, and we've been to lots of events together and individually as well. And you put something out on social media, which actually said it was one of the best exhibitions that you'd been to in a long time and an opening event and that sort of stuff. What was that? What made you say that? Apart from the fact that I'm a really nice guy and we run a podcast together. But
because there was no airs and graces. Everybody was in a really nice mood. I think it's the amount of wine that they brought that helped with that. And it was just genuinely nice without having any pretension. So often there's a kind of, how do you describe it? A kind of...
Cliquiness.
Cliquiness, yeah. And a kind of class element to this, which this didn't have. You know, kind of people coming from, you know, the same old people who go to the same old opening of a paper bag is the cliche. But this didn't have that. It was like a group. It was fresh. It was a new group of people who had been brought together by yourself who weren't previously connected and weren't previously part of a network and hadn't had an exhibition before. So it was new. And it was also because you and I had been involved with the Adult Education Centre doing stuff many years ago. And we experienced the trials and tribulations of that in terms of bringing it forward and that kind of community-focused type creativity. And it's now, it's like, you know, it's nice to see that the cycle has moved on and that people are much more ready to exhibit, but also the space itself is ready to host people and that's its reason for being here. Whereas 10 years ago, the people that were being dealt with in the administrators and the managers just didn't get it. And it was a battle against them. Whereas now, and a lot of kind of heads had to be butted together and all the rest of it now. And if you want to read about that, it's in my PhD. but now it's kind of, you know, it's easier to do. And it's kind of like you'd kind of, something that you'd been arguing about and trying to point in the direction of for years, all of a sudden it's like people have turned up with it and you go, well, how was that? You know, it's like, you know, you're telling everybody about what a wonderful wine is that you've just discovered. And then you turn up at somebody's house one day for, you know, you get invited for dinner and everybody's drinking the same wine and they're all telling you how wonderful it was. But 10 years ago, you were telling them and they wouldn't believe you. You know, it's that kind of thing.
So. Yeah, I agree. I mean, I remember when it was no longer the Central Lending Library and we're sitting now where the record department used to be. So you've got that vision from Chris Minter, the very first person that took it on for Adult Ed, and we started talking about putting together, you know, we built a little radio booth and then we did our first little photo display in the corner. And of course, that then went on and became Leicester People's Photographic Gallery. And you mentioned your PhD there. Well, obviously, that's Ian Davis and the interview that you did with Ian about that. And, you know, and it's evolved. And also the college have started using it more. So, you know, and they've fitted the walls out. So we're at the point where we've got a gallery.
And I think it's a validation for a process. So if you don't invest in this process, are too many things in the arts and culture sector, if you want to call it that, expect instant results. No, this is a long, slow process. You have to build it up and build it up.
So, Tony, let's bring you in here, because you've been around a while as a photographer.
Thank you for reminding me.
Absolutely, yeah. You're a 28-year-old fella like the rest of us, and Vince is slightly younger than us. But I think, you know, you've been around for a while, so you've seen other exhibitions. You've been involved in exhibitions solo and as part of a group. What makes this one feel different for you? Is it your age? Is it what you were showing? Is it your own health issues? Or is it more about, actually, no, it just felt different because it was done in a different way?
Well, there's a few things you've mentioned there. Let me try and put some flesh on that. First of all, I think the opportunity to meet other photographers and see this incredible work, I think that's always a wonderful thing, to know that there's so much talent out there. And it's wonderful for them, as well as myself, to get space. Another reason coming here is that Rob mentioned the People's Photo. I actually had an exhibition there many, many years ago, and I remember Ian and Big John, who's a friend of mine. That was all my pinhole photography, and that was the space upstairs. So this place has a wonderful history with me. Also, before that, because I'm a diarist, I used to spend hours in here writing my diaries and journals. But what I think what's made this special particular is that it's been medicine for me. Street photography is something I've done for many, many years, but I was saying to John recently that I did quite a few years employed as a product photographer, photographing items for a catalogue which destroyed my eye completely. I didn't do anything. So when I retired, I had to learn all over again. And now I'm just out every day, but particularly since my diagnosis, I've been out on the streets. Exercise. I was started photographing in waiting rooms and in actually I was on when I was having a examination at Glenfield, they allowed me to take my camera in, so I was able to my phone, and I was taking pictures of myself on the table and everything that was going on, all street photography to me. And so it's just a wondrous thing. And I've tried to think, I'm going to retire from this, but I just can't. I really, really can't, and I just love doing it.
I think that kind of, I think that kind of photography is addiction as well. It's interesting, isn't it, that you can do photography, because there's a process. And people are falling back in love with film photography and putting their phones down and all that sort of stuff. Whereas you've come at it from the other point of view, where you've looked at how can you upgrade your iPhone with lenses or other cameras with lenses and stuff to kind of fit with where you are on your particular journey. And photography is a journey. And I think some people, it takes over their life. For some people, it is their life. For some people, it's fun. And it's interesting because Rob and I spoke since we interviewed you when we did a podcast here for the opening viewing evening, when we were sitting in exactly the same spot 2 weeks ago having this conversation. Right. And one of the things that Rob and I immediately picked up on in our conversation was the fact that you said, you did product photography, right, and it kind of killed your eye.
Absolutely.
And I thought that was really an interesting comment, which is, just because you're in the photography industry, it doesn't mean you're enjoying it necessarily. It might pay the bills, but you're not enjoying it.
Well, that's all it was, really. It paid the bills. And I don't know. And when I actually retired, the company who I worked for hadn't got anybody in place. So they asked me if I'd do it freelance. And I gave them this ridiculous day rate. And I thought, well, they'll never ask me. But they did. They did. So I did that for 3 years. But that paid for holidays and things. But during that time, I could go out on the streets as well. And I'm particularly interested. I've done street photography all over. I've done it in Japan and in Nicaragua and in the old Soviet Union. But it's never been as good, really, as doing it in your own hometown. I live in the West End, and I love the West End, but photographing in Leicester, and particularly central Leicester, although sometimes I don't like the town. I never go out at night now. I feel too vulnerable. But photographing your hometown, there's nothing like it.
So, Vincey, let's bring you in here.
Hi.
Hello. Co-curating the exhibition with me. What have you enjoyed from the last couple of weeks? And the weeks before that, when you were doing all the coordinating with the photographers and stuff?
Yeah, it's the first time I co-curate the exhibition. And I found that it's quite a little bit challenging compared with being an exhibiting artist. I found that it's kind of you have to focus on everyone's work, and it's kind of organize a group of people, and they are very talented and creative. And I found that this time it's better for me to let them do individual curate their own spaces. Yeah, I found that it's a kind of curation thing. It's very difficult. It's you have an empty wall, and you have to figure out how you lay out your photos, and what kind of photo you want to make them together or separate. And we even have some artist, and she painted on the wall.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because you're here on the day where everyone has to set up, and they all turn up with their images and stuff that they want, and some have got Adam frames, so they're going to be like screwed to the wall, and then Paul Barrand, our technician, can kind of help them, and they kind of, you know, Lee will turn up with for sirens behind me, will turn up with this written or drawn out template of what he wants, and then Paul Vernon will turn up, and he's got like and a massive wall where he's on his fourth version of the plan, and then there's other people turn up and they put things up against the wall. Yeah, and then they look at you, and then you look at them, and it's like a Mexican standoff, you know. And it's like, wow, wow, wow. Who's going to do the next thing? You know, who's going to make a decision about where the first picture goes? And then sometimes it works, and sometimes it doesn't. You know, because they've not really thought about it. This kind of body of work that ultimately they're displaying. If it's for the first time, you kind of understand that maybe they're a little bit nervous and not quite sure why. And then other times, it's like, why haven't you thought through how you want these things to connect together? I mean, I know, Tony, you said to me, look, you know, I want this one of me taken by my granddaughter front and centre with the bio underneath, and then I'll build out from the left and right. You'd thought about it already. So, How important is it for you to think about your things that you want curated and how you want it to display?
Well, I've been very fortunate over the years that I've had people that have helped me. My good friend John Toy put up the last exhibition of mine at the church. Remember that, Rob? The one in the church 4 years ago? That was called a society chorale. But I think it's also important to actually let other people look at your work, and they will see it differently from you, and they've been able to point out things that I can't see or I've not seen. And it's nice to, you know, just for me, just to concentrate on the photographs and then not have to worry about. I mean, Paul, who put my pictures up, he said, yeah, that's fine, we'll do that. And he made it look great. And it was fine, yeah.
When you take photographs, do you see them as individuals? So say you're out doing a walk later on today. Are you taking individual photographs, or are you thinking, actually, today I'm going to see people that are from different countries, or I'm going to look at buildings with people that are in front of them doing interesting things? Do you wait for the photograph to find
no,
you?
No, it's just
you're not thinking about how you're going to display them or a series. You're thinking of them as individuals.
No, We come back to the old Henri Cartier-Bresse thing about the decisive moment.
Which, you did exactly what I thought you would do, which is do that. Thank you. Yeah.
No, I'm just all I am is a snapshot photographer. Anybody could do what I do. I just do it with passion.
Yeah.
I photograph anything.
And your exhibition's called Indecisive Moments.
Indecisive Moments, yes. It's the antithesis to that nonsense.
This is John Costa with Rob Watson on Spotlight on Art. And for this recording, we're down in the basement gallery again at Leicester Adult Education Centre as we're taking down Doc Photo 8, the exhibition for the last 2 weeks. For me, I think one of the things that I particularly enjoyed was I know when I put an event on, I can normally get about 20 to 25 people will turn up. People I know on WhatsApp and Facebook and stuff like that. If I message them, they kind of know what I'm about and what I do and maybe hopefully the quality, to mention the quality word, of what I do. It's going to be a good event and they'll turn up. But to have 11 photographers as well, I think for me, was a way of also they'll come with someone that they know. They might bring some friends from work. They might bring some friends from uni or from college. They might come with family. And suddenly, what I particularly like about the opening event was there was people that I didn't invite, but that I knew. Mm. And they were like, oh, John, are you exhibiting today? And I was like, well, no, I'm organising. Oh, okay, right. So it's even when they know what you do, or they think they know what they do, you do through Facebook, they're still surprised that they turn up at an event that you've organised. I was like, I've been like promoting this for weeks. So it's really strange. And then you'll meet someone yesterday who came down, Sue, and she said to me, oh, you know, it's great, isn't it, this exhibition? I said, yeah, I helped to organise it. She said, oh, right, okay. And she said, I'm doing one again in September. She said, oh, right, okay. I said, I've been promoting it on Facebook. Oh, I don't go on Facebook. And actually, you think, if you're not on Facebook and if you're not on Instagram, I can understand why you might have an issue with the owner or the company or the algorithms and what it does. But it's how else do you know, and I'm going to bring Rob in here, in this city, about what's going on? Because there's the odd wall about, you know, putting a post on a wall at, say, the depot, but we don't have that. And we've been trying to get this scene where people, you know, this community, this ecosystem of people that are able to support each other through doing different things. Where do you find out about what's on? You know, we don't have a printed what's on.
How long have we got?
About two and a half minutes.
The I think the fragmentation, the social fragmentation, and this is why these kind of events and exhibitions are really important, because we've diced and sliced identity-based culture in places like Leicester. So there are particularly dominant models of identity based around race and ethnicity, based around migration, those kind of things. And they tend to get pushed to the fore and supported by the big institutions because that's what gets funding. And then those networks of people who are not within those kind of, not part of the, you can name a number of communities in Leicester that have a kind of a repeated presence within cultural events, and they're celebrated Diwali, a Caribbean Carnival, Indian Festival, those kind of things. But then there's a whole load of people in the city who never get any attention. The East Asian, Chinese, Vietnamese, Thai communities don't get any kind of regard. The East Europeans, East Mediterranean, and so there's kind of like a hierarchy of attention, and it's almost like kind of look at me. And keep looking at me, and it's like, well, that's not actually what is going on. And things about the way that we use social media is to work across those kind of boundaries. And I think part of the challenge and what we can learn from things like this is, you know, it's not what we did in the past, and it's not what motivates us to account for things that were done in the past. It's really about what we're going to be doing next and what we contribute. So an awful lot of things look backwards and or look inwards to a community, and they don't challenge people to look forwards and say, well, what are you going to leave? And I think, you know, talking to Tony is really important, because, you know, you as you've described, you've got one foot in the grave, and you're thinking ahead, literally. And you're still thinking ahead. And it's like, and you're not melancholic, or you're not, you know, overly romantic about the past.
No.
But it's like you're saying, okay, well, what is next? How do we move forward the next generation?
So Tony, I want to touch on Wapping. We'll talk about Wapping and the 40th anniversary of Wapping, because I'm from the East End of London, so I can remember, you know, running down the highway and having, like, you know, lines of police and vehicles kerning and everyone shouting scab and all that sort of stuff. So what I'd like to do is just pick your brains a little bit about how important things like Wapping are and stuff, and then we'll take it from there. So Tony, why did you end up photographing the Wapping dispute at the time?
Well, this was 1985, 86, when it all started happening. I was honing myself as a street photographer then, back in the 80s, but in between bouts of drunkenness and drug taking, I was an addict in those days. So, I was working in the industry, and we had the opportunity, or I had the opportunity to go down and see for myself. I'd seen all the news reports, but I thought that there's nothing like going down yourself and witnessing and taking a look. So one Saturday morning, I packed up my cameras and I went down, found myself to Wapping, was met with a massive police presence around, and who were telling me to get off the road or get off the pavement. And I met some of the guys there, and I've got a wonderful picture somewhere with me with the pickets. And there you learn the stories from the heart about how these men, because it was mostly men, how they were treated and how they were really didn't have a lot of choice. I mean, I was saying to John earlier, something like Wapping, it depends who you talk to. People have got different views of this, but it was certainly where technology was changing. Unions were being destroyed. It was the end of what we called the closed shop. Do you remember the closed shop? Where you had to be a union member to actually work. And I realised then that I was photographing history. But I never, ever thought up until that point that I would see British policemen attacking British workmen, workforces. And that to me was abhorrent. But of course, we all know how it turned out. But the technology had changed, and that was the big problem for a lot of people. But fascinating to see how over the years, it's actually what we used to call the working man, how the rights have been decimated, really. So it was a point in history, but it's largely forgotten now, I would say. Would you, John? I don't think too many people.
Yeah, I mean, again, in the conversation earlier, we were talking about sort of, you know, I think it was the anniversary of Orgreave recently, wasn't it?
The UK government announced a inquiry into revisiting the policing for that. So I wouldn't, that's not too far of a step away from looking at the policing of Wapping as well.
All of those things. And I think, you know, this week's been full of sort of, you know, protests in Epping and migrant hotels and you know, looking at the policing there, but they're much more forensically looked at now because people are there with cameras able to record, and also there's no control over where you post it or even the comment that you make with the your own narration of that event live, whether that's on TikTok or on YouTube. So I think going back to then, it was only people like you with a camera or someone with a camera from the mainstream media would capture. I mean, there's very famous, you know, horses charging or Orgreave, charging the lines, but there were no individual protesters there that would have been live streaming what was going on. So if you're not doing that, then you don't have your own documentary evidence of what's happening.
And the boundary in terms of news reporting has changed as well. So those cameras are now in citizens' hands, which is something, you know, we've got lots of experience of
changing the narrative, isn't it?
It's distributed, so it's no longer, you know, you don't go to ITN or the BBC for the news about this. You're looking at things on YouTube and TikTok, and you're seeing direct video and photographs that are being published directly, perhaps unfiltered, and that's a danger. There's a good question. Can I jump in with a question for Vinci, which is the kind of photography's role in dissent, managing and talking about dissent in China. Is that something that, I mean, I'm not saying that you reveal any political thoughts yourself, but is there a role for the kind of photography that you do, which is maybe, is it acceptable, or is it considered as being unusual, let's say, or not approved?
This market photo is approval in China. But in China, I found that because I had solo exhibition before and I had my own curator at that time, and I showed him several of my series, and he found that the photo in Xinjiang province, it's very great, but he is very, very careful.
Cautious.
Yeah. He's very cautious about that work because that area is a kind of sensitive area in China. So we didn't do that. Yeah, and in China, you cannot tell politics things, especially lockdown.
So just for the final session now, Tony, you want to make a point?
It's very interesting, this about the use of photography with, particularly with political events these days. Now, I'm a Christian, so I know a lot about the, through Amnesty International, the reports in North Korea, where there is 250,000 Christians held in gulags. Now, the world ignores that, because there's nothing to gain from it. There's no oil involved. There's no minerals involved. But nobody has been allowed to get in there and to photograph it. Now, I find that quite horrific, really. But I found it, over the years, I found it more and more difficult. That's why I don't do it anymore. I used to photograph a lot of political events. I photographed Gerry Adams and Jeremy Corbyn together in London in the early 1990s. But I think that was about the end of it. And these days, with this police idea of kettling and me with being ill with, you know, with cancer and stuff, I don't think I could stand being kettled in and being held in a group. So I just don't do it anymore. And it's such a shame.
I guess also it's thinking about how our news agenda has changed about, you know, it's dominated by everything in America or Donald Trump and stuff. So a lot of the stuff that goes on there, if you didn't go to TikTok or social media or Instagram Reels or any of those kind of things, Facebook Live, you would never actually see a lot of the stuff that's going on, because it doesn't get reported on the mainstream. You know, we're going over to America because Donald Trump has decided he's going to do something. So I think also from my perspective, looking at your Whopping work, and I guess this is really where my interest in documentary media comes in, which is like film, photography, audio and new media and stuff, is the fact that it's not necessarily those photographs were of their time and were important. Did you show them then, Tony? And who did you show them to? It's now 40 years later, presenting it in a way which is actually, was this the turning point in technology and workers where suddenly you'd captured a moment which has actually been repeated many times?
Yeah. I'm very interested to look at them myself, actually, because they were developed in a hurry. They've never been seen publicly. And so there may be a slight deterioration of the negative, but I think that'll add to it. That will add to the effect of when we eventually get these printed up and used. So,
well, I don't know if the word kinetic is the right one, but you saying like slightly blurry and, you know, degrading and stuff, that was, if I think about Whopping, that's what it was. It was this fast-moving thing. I can remember running down the highway past the protesters that were there, the guys that were on strike, and then there was the row of police. And as I got to that corner, it absolutely kicked off. It was like scum and scab and all this stuff. And it absolutely erupted. And I remember thinking for a split second, what have I done? I'm out for a run, you know, back from the army. And then a couple of coaches went past, and of course they kind of erupted because the coaches were going in for the shift work, and then it kind of calmed down again, and it was very surreal. So that kind of blurry, kinetic, fast-moving situation would probably take people into the heart of actually what it was like.
I think that's very true. And another set of negatives I've got, which I found recently, was when I photographed the leaders of the National Front, and that was terrifying. And that was on the New Parks Estate. And that was absolutely terrifying. But again, it was a point in history.
And why were you doing that? Let's pick up on that.
Why was I doing that? Well, I was invited to go along by a police contact. And so I got, who sadly is no longer with us, but I got access fairly up close. And there was John Tyndall and Richard Edmonds and the local guy, John Peacock at the time. And they were all busting from London. And it's interesting to know because the same people I photographed there on that day were the very same people I'd photographed 3 years before in London. So it was like rent a mob, really. But absolutely terrifying. I'm not sure I've got the energy to do something like that these days.
Yeah. And what's interesting, you talking about that as well, I would almost say, like your Wapping photos, those photos are of their time, but are also particularly relevant now, isn't it, where we talk about Rent-A-Mob and certain names and certain characters that are involved in certain things, or agitation,
and whipping
up the sort of the populace into...
Yeah, I don't think I would exhibit them, to be honest. I think, especially these days with social media, because they could be turned into something that they're not.
But this is where I'm thinking about the documentary aspect and where you've deposited all of your stuff down in the East End of London at the Bishopsgate Institute is the fact that it's then available for people to use at the right time in the right way to bring
like a book, a book which gives context would be. Yeah. I think they should, never discount people.
Maybe social media.
People can judge and form opinions. The photograph is as it is.
And
trying to, it's of its moment, it's of its time, and educating people about the capacity to take that without it having to be explained to them is, we've got to, I think part of it, we have to give people credit for what they do.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, right. So just coming up to the end now. Thank you, Tony, for joining us.
Thank you.
As always. And Vincey, last word to you as the co-curator. Go for it.
Yeah, sorry. Can I correct my answer that... it is the curator. He thinks that Xinjiang province is a kind of sensitive area. So he didn't want to take a risk to show that. But actually, I think that it's not that sensitive.
Interesting, isn't it? We could have a whole separate podcast about censorship and... sensitive issues.
Oh, I'd be up for that.
Yeah. So thank you very much for joining us. Thanks again, Rob.